you know, I want to be read. If I write something that I think is great and nobody sees it, that is not a success. I want to do stuff that is new and interesting and true to our mission. So my goal is to find this intersection between what I care about, what our readers care about, what stands a chance of getting clicks, what people will actually talk about, and when a story kind of checks off all those boxes, it's exciting.
Welcome to the Stream and Allison and Partners podcast, where we break down what is trending and why it matters. I'm your host, Allie Warshavsky.
I'm Owen Clark.
And today we've got a very special edition of the podcast. If you are a dedicated listener, like we know you all are, we have Rafe, who was on our last podcast, and he is one of the senior vice presidents in our technology practice. And he's speaking to Harry McCracken of Fast Company. Now, they've worked together in the past, and recently, Harry put together what is somewhat rare these days, a very long form article on the history of LinkedIn. So Rafe, Owen, and Harry all got together to speak about one, LinkedIn and its history, and two, what goes into writing an article of this length, and are journalists simply writing articles this length anymore?
It was great to, you know, have everyone together IRL in the podcast studio, which we don't get to do a ton. And like you said, to go into this art form that I think in some ways is at least overlook. A lot of what we do with clients is educating them on the new media landscape, which is everything moving fast, fewer journalists, fewer outlets, everyone turning content faster and faster, like you said, for social. But Harry is in some ways the opposite. He's really created this career that's focused on thoughtful research, dedicated, and sometimes long-form writing. And this article was a great example of that. So it was great to hear from him sort of how this still exists, what the lane is for companies and brands to fit in it, and sort of what it means for journalism as a whole. So again, really enjoyed the conversation. It's obviously focused on sort of print in that longer form. But Ali, you've worked in television for a long time, which historically has really been fast, right, because of the daily deadlines. But there are opportunities to go deeper. I guess, is there a story that sticks with you that you worked on for a long time and sort of fits in this version of more thoughtful, nuanced reporting?
Yeah, and you might remember, Owen, from your time. We have this period called sweeps. I believe it's four times a year, although you block it out because it's so stressful that you try not to remember it, where you are allowed to do these in-depth pieces because it's when ratings, quote unquote, take place, which is so funny because now with streaming services and the fact that all your stories go on the web anyway, ratings is kind of a controversial topic. Are people, does it matter if people are tuning in at 6 p.m. and you're getting registered on the Nielsen ratings, or are they streaming anyway? But that's when you're given the liberty to really look into a piece that you can dedicate more time to. And then when I was in Raleigh, because I was a traffic reporter, I was kind of assigned these more in-depth looks at data of tragedy on the roads, you know, certain areas of the highway that seem to be seeing more deaths because of crashes, or pedestrians where they were getting struck, and then looking at the data, spending weeks looking at the data, collecting the interviews. And usually you're given a minute 10 and it's wrap. But for these, you're giving almost up to 3 minutes of time to really tell a story, which is extremely rare in television.
And weeks, and sometimes days at least, or weeks to research it, right? Which is also the thing that you miss. And I think Harry talked a lot about how many journalists and how many interviews and how many hours they put together. And again, this is important, right? It's important for the medium. It's important for the role that we all as society expect journalism to do. And right, so it is really reassuring, at least for me, and I'm sure for you, to feel like this still exists. It's maybe different now than it was 10 or 15 years ago, but it's still super important for the readers. It's super important for the communities they serve. And it's nice for the brands and the PR people who are trying to get included in these pieces, which is another thing we touch on with Harry. So again, I think it's a really interesting conversation. We try to keep it short. We could have been on for hours, but it's something I think everyone will have a chance to enjoy, and stick around and check it out.
Well, welcome everybody into the San Francisco Allison & Partners podcast studio. Excited to have two in-real-life guests, which is pretty unusual these days for a podcast. First up, our first ever repeat guest that we've had, Head of Technology Content at Allison & Partners, Rafe Needleman. Rafe, thanks for being back.
Oh, it's great to be here again. Thank you.
And our special outside expert today, global technology editor for Fast Company, Harry McCracken. Harry, thanks so much for coming. It's a rainy day in San Francisco. You made it in person. We really appreciate it.
It's great to see some other human beings.
We're going to talk and go deep into the story you worked on LinkedIn and sort of the state of featured journalism. But first, you guys go back, talk about how you first met, where you've intersected in journalism over the last couple decades.
Well, when you've been doing this for as long as Rafe and I have, you tend to know each other, at least if you're doing it in the same city.
Mm-hmm.
I can't actually remember how we met, although we had a number of mutual friends even before we met. I remember having dinner with you at Demo years ago.
Oh, yeah, Demo. Those were fun. That's probably several of those. We used to see each other at trade shows all the time, and we're in the same business. And there was a period where we had similarly configured facial hair, and we were mistaken for each other. Do you remember those days?
My wife brings it up quite often.
Yeah.
I had some weird experiences with people thinking I was Rafe, and I was relieved to hear that he had the same experience at least once or twice in the opposite direction.
I was really interested to talk to you about this particular story, which you wrote called, which is online now, called LinkedIn Turns 20, An Oral History of an Unlikely Champion. So introduce the story. What is it, where can people find it?
Well, they can find it on our site and also in our new March-April issue, which will be hitting newsstands right about now. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, essentially this one case where I can credit our editor-in-chief, Brendan Vaughn, with the idea, because it was totally his idea. I think it dawned on him that LinkedIn was about to turn 20, and there aren't all that many startups that were founded 20 years ago that still exist at all, let alone are as significant as LinkedIn is. But even though presumably something close to 100% of our readers are on LinkedIn, and probably a fair amount of them get at least some value out of it, you don't hear all that much about LinkedIn. It's just sort of been quietly successful, and it was even bought by Microsoft and continued to be successful, which is fairly unusual for something to thrive once it's been bought by a giant. I believe Brendan also proposed doing it as an oral history, which is a really fun format. We don't do all that often. When I heard the notion that it should be an oral history, I got excited partially because it sounded easy. Writing is hard, and in the oral history, there's just a tiny bit of writing to kind of bridge some of the quotes, but the story is 98% quotes. As I got into working on this, and I should mention that we threw a number of people at this. I had four or five colleagues who did some of the interviews because we decided we wanted to do dozens of interviews on a fairly short timetable. So I did a whole bunch of them, and some of my colleagues did more of them. We ended up with more than 250,000 words of content. It quickly dawned on me that actually oral histories are really hard because if you're writing part of it, it's easy because you get to decide what words are on the page and you can link stuff together and do transitions. And with this, we did not want to have a lot of my words in there. And generally speaking, like one sound bite on its own doesn't really work. You want to have the sound bites relate to each other. And sifting through a quarter of a million words and finding the stuff and figuring out how to piece it all together was actually a pretty major challenge.
I do want to get into the mechanics of putting a story like this together because I looked at that and I did a tiny part in the story. So I was interested in how the rest of it worked. But before that, you know, talk about what the goal of the story was. What were you trying to accomplish with this massive amount of work?
I think like the highest level goal was to point out all how significant LinkedIn is, even though most people don't sit there and think about it all that much. And it's not addictive in the way that a Facebook or Instagram or TikTok can be. It's been actually, I think, pretty successful at doing its job of helping people find other people who might be helpful to them in their careers. It's clearly our era's major job site, even though it does not position itself as a job site. There had not been like a really definitive history of LinkedIn up until now. It's always nice to find a story that you think people will like. It has not been done to death.
Do you come away from the story, or do you think readers should come away with a particular message on this history, on this from this particular story?
Well, I think one of the major themes is that you can argue that social networking has not been a great thing for the world in general. Like on balance, you can make the case that Facebook has been either good for the world or bad for the world. The truth is probably somewhere in the middle. But because LinkedIn focused on people's professional lives, it gave people a very strong incentive not to be jackasses. If you're somewhere where you're among people who might be interested in giving you a job, you're probably a little bit less likely to be a troll. Put the most positive version of yourself front and center. And so it managed to avoid all these other social networking issues. And the business model actually turned out to be really great. Most social networks run on advertising, and there have been just a handful of them that have succeeded with that. But it's very hard to be dependent on advertising. And while LinkedIn does have ads, it also has a lot of people who happily pay for a premium service. You can pay to do things like send a message to somebody you're not connected to. The job listings are a big business. It's doing a bunch of things that are evenly spread out. And while it's not as big as Facebook, it's really big. And presumably, Microsoft is pretty pleased with the revenue it sees every year, which is continuing to grow. And mm-hmm. another interesting tidbit is, basically, since everybody I know is on LinkedIn and has been for many years, I kind of assumed it wasn't really growing all that quickly. In fact, while we were working on this story, they had their biggest day ever in terms of new signups. So they've actually figured out how to reach out to the kind of folks who have not been on LinkedIn for years and years, which includes sort of almost anybody who is not sort of a knowledge worker or white-collar person. There are all these people in other professions, including like people who work on their feet or people like electricians. In the past, they did not have a lot of incentive to join LinkedIn, but they figured out how to do things to make it interesting to them too. So LinkedIn is still growing 20 years later, which is really unusual.
That's odd for a startup, for companies that we cover. Are you happy with the story? Are you happy with the way it turned out?
I pause because I'm never 100% satisfied. And if you were thrilled, it's probably not a great sign because you always aspire to do something even better than you did. I'd say we ended up with a lot of material and had to make some hard decisions. And there are a number of kind of sub-stories we could have included.
And I think one of the things that's was really interesting is the length piece, right? I think we spend a lot of our time working with clients, just educating them on how fast the media moves today, right? You're seeing multiple stories a day. You're seeing journalists be pressured to tweet from an announcement interview. And this is obviously more thoughtful and long form. Like, how would you balance that need to still constantly be churning out stories while you have this other piece you're working on that's longer? And how unusual is that today in the climate that we're in?
Well, it was definitely a challenge. And that's one reason why we put a bunch of people on this project. I'd say my own philosophy, particularly on the web, is that every story should be as long as it should be. In some cases, that's 150 words. I think the longest stuff we've ever published on our website is maybe like 12,000 words. And as long as you can figure out how to make it happen, you should make it as long as it should be, but no longer. This seemed like an instance where people would find value in it being kind of long. And in fact, it kind of dawned on us. We were getting all this fascinating stuff that had never been published. And at some point, I almost felt like an obligation to share it. And I hope that maybe even like 5 years from now, if somebody is researching the history of LinkedIn, they will find the story and it will kind of be the oral history of record. But all along, I was also working on other projects too, some of which were like 400-word stories. And so it did involve a lot of effort and the occasional long night, and also just sort of figuring out how to do an oral history in terms of processing all the raw material.
And just generally speaking, can you talk about just the shift you've seen toward faster turn, more stories over your time? I mean, if you were to compare sort of the deadline you approach or the way you'd focus on one or two stories a day and how that shifted now, how is it different?
Well, I got my start in this business working for monthly magazines, and we all thought we were incredibly overworked. And in retrospect, it was pretty easy because if you did like two pieces in a monthly magazine, you would like ask for an issue off because you were exhausted. And the web just does not work that way. People don't want interesting stuff every 30 days. They want interesting stuff every day, and in some cases, like every hour. I'm lucky to work with a lot of talented people, and I'd say each of us on staff kind of has a somewhat different duty. We have some people who are totally, primarily expected to write many short stories, usually tied to the news. I kind of have the luxury of having the bandwidth to work on longer pieces and things that require more thinking and planning. And last year I did a story on Intel that I worked on and off for a year. I'm very grateful that Fast Company cares about this kind of story, and our readers do. And in fact, it turns out to be a good business if you do unique stuff. So our goal with most of the stories we do is to try to find ideas where we can bring added Fast Company specialness and where we don't have a lot of competition from other people doing something similar. And LinkedIn is a good example of that.
I was impressed by the star power in the story, because I noticed, I'm just reading through the story, and I noticed there's Richard Branson, there's Arianna Huffington, there's Satya Nadella. Of course, Reid Hoffman is there. Of those like celebrity gets, which was, say, the most difficult, or which one are you the most happy to get and that you enjoyed the most?
Having Branson and Arianna Huffington was cool, and I those were both interviews that one of my colleagues did, so I don't take any personal credit for those. We certainly knew we wanted Satya Nadella because this is this major acquisition and moment for LinkedIn, and it turned out to be pretty successful because Microsoft has done a good job of leaving LinkedIn alone. And so we made that ask, and Microsoft seemed receptive. One of the challenges here is that a lot of the people we wanted are extremely busy. At one point, fairly late in the story, there were a number of like holes of people we knew were absolutely essential, and we did not yet have those interviews. You know, we put together this print version, and print stories still require a lot of care and attention and multiple levels of editing, and it has to be shipped out weeks before it actually appears. I added a few interviews to our online version after print had shipped because I thought they were cool and they made the story better.
Speaking of which, you and I, the reason we're having this discussion is because you reached out to me because early on in, when I was a columnist for, I think it was Business 2.0, I wrote something favorable about LinkedIn, which apparently some people noticed, and you certainly did 20 years later. And we had a nice talk, and I'm reading the online story, and there's this one little quote for me, which made me very happy. And then I'm seeing the print version, and there's no quote for me. Harry, what happened to it?
Another big difference between print and online is a lot of the stuff you read by me online, I basically did a lot of the editing myself. Like I'm an editor slash writer, which for obvious reasons can be a lot of fun. And print is not like that. Print still reflects many brains. And my colleague Jill Bernstein was the editor of the story. Jill had some thoughts about stuff. And Brendan, our editor-in-chief, who came up with this idea, had some feedback. And so did some other folks. And so we added a little bit of stuff after the first draft. And some stuff had to go. And I'm sorry to say, Rafe, you were one of those people. But having edited you out of print, I knew I wanted you to be online. And I also put in some other folks who were not in print online because we were very grateful to these people for spending time with us.
There's an interesting part of the story when it came to, we were talking about the early days of LinkedIn and the growth of it and trying to lift LinkedIn out of the morass of other social networks. And there's this thing in here you have from the PR world I found really interesting. You said, you have this quote in the story from Kay Luo, who was a senior director of corporate communications in some of the early days. There's a quote from her. Guy Kawasaki, who was, of course, a big shot in the world of tech, Guy Kawasaki was not shy about bashing LinkedIn. So one of the first things I did, this is Kay, one of the first things I did was help him draft a post on 10 ways you can use LinkedIn. He ended up publishing that post, and it became the most read post he'd ever published. And then you have this quote from Guy following that, "I completely changed my mind," which this is a gigantic communications win. Talk to me about that idea of a quote of what she said, which is of helping writers draft a post. Is that something you can still do?
Well, it was interesting to see her speak that way because I certainly, as a journalist, have learned that essentially if I'm working with a PR person on a story, I certainly think that it's my story, but PR people will think of it as their story and think of themselves as having accomplished something, assuming the story turns out in a way that's a win for them. And so I was not surprised to see Kay talk about it that way.
How do you measure the success of a story like this? It gets out in the world. You start getting feedback from people who see it. Just what's that life cycle like for you as the writer?
I mean, there are a whole bunch of factors. On the most boring, mundane level, you would like people to read it, which means they have to click on it. And certainly, we certainly do things like look at the clicks. And if there are lots of clicks, that's great news. And if there are fewer than we hope for, that's not so great. And we might try new ways to promote it. But it's not just about the clicks, I have to say. That's another great thing about Fast Company. We kind of have the luxury of not being like a sausage machine where every single decision is made to get as many clicks as possible. We want to bring new ideas to people and give them new insights and be influential. We've gotten tons of great feedback on the story based on those factors. South by Southwest, members of our team were there, and I wasn't. But apparently we got lots of great feedback on the story from people at South by Southwest, and it was kind of the talk of the show, or at least one of the topics that got lots of buzz, and that was great to hear.
It sounds like, you know, Fast Company has a bit of a unique approach, or you personally feel that way. But if you just look at bigger picture and talk to your colleagues, how is that tracking change? I mean, we hear from reporters anecdotally about the sort of increased metrics they need to live up to. That, again, it used to be you put a story out in a monthly, maybe people write some letters, here's sort of anecdotal feedback. Now you can, you know, see the graphs in real time. Like, how do you think that's changed the way reporters do their job?
There's an array of reactions by reporters to the fact these numbers exist, ranging from kind of having an unhealthy obsession with clicks and caring only about clicks and being kind of willing to do stories, which probably are not great Fast Company stories if they will get a lot of clicks, to people who absolutely kind of don't care and don't even have logins for our analytics system and kind of feel that it's beneath them to care at all. I think there's a happy medium, which I try to meet, which is, you know, I want to be read. If I write something that I think is great and nobody sees it, that is not a success. But again, I want to do stuff that is new and interesting and true to our mission. So my goal is to find this intersection between what I care about, what our readers care about, what stands a chance of getting clicks, what people will actually talk about, and when a story kind of checks off all those boxes, it's exciting. We also, by the way, clicks on some level are an unhealthy thing to care about, because all that means essentially is that your headline was pretty good. There are cases where a story gets tons of clicks and it's a long story, but you see that the average reader stayed on it for like 12 seconds. That is not a good sign about your story. You if it's a really long story, you want to see that people at least spent several minutes reading it. And so it's just as important to look at that number.
And there's obviously a whole set of metrics that these PR people use to measure success. Talk about where PR people fit best into something like a story you're working on over multiple days or weeks.
Right. I mean, there are certainly cases where PR people come to us with opportunities we get excited about. Most often, those are opportunities involving getting news, maybe exclusive news, getting to talk to important people within a company, being able to tell kind of a behind-the-scenes story that works really well for us. Along with all the pitches we get that are not on target for us, we certainly get some that are great. And then there are all the stories where we generate the idea. And in some cases, those ideas are not really contingent on getting a lot of help from the companies involved or PR people. In some cases, kind of we can't do the story unless we get that access. Mm-hmm. And then there are ones like this that are a little bit in the middle. We did find a lot of these people on our own. But if we had not been able to talk to any current LinkedIn employees, we couldn't really tell the current story of the company. And we certainly knew we wanted to talk to people like Ryan Roslansky, who's the current CEO. So if LinkedIn had just been disinterested in this story or you know, even did not want it to exist, we would have been in trouble. I'd say, fortunately, they also thought it was a cool idea. And so they provided lots of help. And we could have done kind of the first 60% of the story, maybe without them helping. The 40% that's more recent, we really, really required them to be excited about it. And luckily for us, they were.
So let's pretend instead of doing a giant history on LinkedIn, you were doing a giant history on Enron. And the communications people at Enron were maybe a little less interested in being open with the media, with you. How would you have approached them and the story differently?
Does this assume that Enron still exists?
This assumes the Enron that we know, which was a not favorable contributor to our economy overall.
Yes. Well, I mean, that certainly happens. And I'll even give you an actual real-world example, which is a few years ago, Austin Carr, who at the time was one of my colleagues, and I did a cover story for Fast Company on Twitter. And it was primarily about the degree to which Twitter had been overcome by trolls and misinformation and haters, and it had become a really unpleasant place. And their somewhat mixed record of dealing with that. We wanted to tell the whole story and tell it accurately, and in fact, explain the measures they had taken, which in some cases had made some progress. Twitter's chief PR person at the time was wholly disinterested in the story, and so we didn't get any help at all from them. They maybe did a tiny bit of fact-checking, but even that they were not very enthusiastic about. So we put together a cover story on Twitter in Fast Company without any help from Twitter. Mm-hmm. We'd actually, a few years before that, we had done another cover story they did help with, and we did a photo shoot with Jack Dorsey for this earlier story. And if you were paying very careful attention to this second, less positive story, you might have noticed that Jack Dorsey on our cover did not have a beard at a time when he did have a beard in real life. And that's because it was a rather old photograph, but a very nice one. And we knew we were not going to get Jack Dorsey to sit for a photo shoot because we couldn't even get Jack Dorsey to talk to us for that particular story.
You put him on the cover without his cooperation?
We did.
Wow. Okay. So on the other flip side of that, so say there's a company like we talked about before who's coming up on a milestone anniversary, 10-year, 15, 20-year anniversary, and they look at this LinkedIn story and it's like, I want one of those. What are you going to tell them?
I get that a lot. one of the challenges probably about the media in general and definitely about me is that when I do a story, people of a certain type, people take that as a sign I want to do lots more stories of that type. Oftentimes it's a sign I'm not going to come back to that type of story for months or years or maybe ever.
We've been in the media industry for a long time, started with print journalism with these long leads and kind of constrained circulation and feedback loops. And now we're in a world of influencers where anybody and everybody can post their opinions and sometimes get an amazing followership. What is your view of the role of what you're working on right now, which is kind of big brand, heavy-hitting, resourced journalism versus the independent influencer economy?
Well, I'm glad they both exist. I love working for Fast Company, but I also had my own site, Technologizer, some time ago, which I built from scratch and did primarily on my own. And that was a lot of fun, too. In the old days of print media, you kind of knew who your competition was. And in some cases, it was kind of like unbelievably clear. I worked at PC World magazine, which had this arch rival PC magazine. And the fact we had an arch rival certainly shaped our thinking in a lot of ways. I'd say in general online, your competition is not one or two brands. It's like almost anybody. And it might be another large media company. It might be an individual. It's not so much about brands competing with each other. In most cases, it's kind of about stories competing with each other. If I write about a particular topic, I feel like I'm competing with anybody else who did something similar. And ideally, my story is better than theirs and maybe came out a little earlier. And people kind of understand that it's really great and are more likely to link to it.
If you look forward, I guess, you'd say you're talking to a 25-year-old journalist or a 20-year-old aspiring journalist. What do you see the landscape looking like in the next 5 to 10 years?
I mean, there are certainly journalists who, if they get that question, they say, like, hey, kid, don't get into this business.
Yeah, get out quick.
The golden age was, the 90s or 80s or maybe the 70s. And it's certainly true. There are kind of fewer typical journalism jobs. I'm kind of amazed I still have something that's recognizable as doing something similar to what I was doing in the 90s because most of my old friends from that era are doing something different, such as Rafe. I love what I do. I think the opportunities are still there. I mean, back in the 90s, if you wrote about PCs, PCs were kind of this self-contained topic that did not have all that much influence on the rest of the world. And today, technology is one of the biggest stories there is and intersects with every other big story from politics to culture to entertainment. So I find this still to be really rewarding work. I think you do have to be kind of intrepid if you want to get in this business. You can't aspire to work for a big brand and have that be the only thing that you're willing to do because you might be better off working on your own or having some kind of a job that's not working for a brand like Fast Company or Time or PC World where I've worked and those brands were all familiar. You might need to start something on your own. But on the other hand, in the old days, if you wanted to write about technology, for the most part, you kind of had to find some large company who was willing to give you a job and publish you on Twitter or something like a blog or in something like LinkedIn. The 25-year-old who's just getting into the business has equal access to that. And if they can create something compelling, they stand a chance of getting read by more people than I do. And so, well, there certainly are instances where being affiliated with a brand like Fast Company is helpful. There are all kinds of instances where almost anybody who can create something compelling has an equally good chance of people caring about it, which ultimately I'd say is exciting.
What's next for Harry?
Well, generally, this is really unusual. I'm talking about the story because for the most part, the moment I click publish on something I've done online, I kind of forget about it and kind of literally can't tell you about it because I've moved on to the next thing. And I get lots of email from PR people who say, Harry, I'd love to hear what you're working on now in case I can be helpful. My answer is generally, I can't tell you what I'm working on now. In fact, it's deeply secret until we get it ready because we certainly don't want anybody else to learn about where we're working on and rush out something similar. And even this LinkedIn story, I only told people about it if we were asking them to be part of it. and I'm certainly working on a number of things now I don't want to talk about, which are equally cool. But there is, that's a long way to give you an actual answer, which is this is a fairly unusual moment for tech in that topic-wise, there is one most important topic, and that is generative AI, which looks like it might be one of these inflection points similar to the PC in the 70s and 80s, and the World Wide Web in the 90s, and mobile earlier in the century, where it has a huge impact and disrupts a lot of stuff that looked like it was not going to get disrupted, and people really care about it. And so at the moment, if you go to our tech section on fastcompany.com, you will see we're doing tons of stories on this topic, and we've allocated a pretty sizable percentage of our resources to it, and people just can't get enough of it. And it's pretty clear that it's not just hot today, but something that will have a permanent influence on what we write about, and it's not entirely clear how that will play out.
Well, Harry, thank you so much for taking the time on the podcast today. Tons of really interesting stuff. Obviously, you can read the story, it sounds like, on the Fast Company website. As we heard, there'll be a print edition maybe out by the time this podcast launches. So lots of places to check out that and all your work. Thank you so much.
I should also mention I have a newsletter called Plugged In, which people can subscribe to. If you go to our site, you can find out how to subscribe to that during our other newsletters. And newsletters are also fun.
Well, thank you again, Harry. It's great to catch up.
Thanks, folks. This was great.
Thanks again to Harry and Ray for joining us today. And as Harry mentioned, as we look at big trending stories, generative AI continues to be a huge story for Fast Company. There's lots of great reporting out there on it, including the previous edition of this podcast, where we go deep with Ray about what generative AI means specifically for PR people in the communications industry. So a really great listening if you haven't already checked that out. If you already subscribed, that's the easiest way to get all the episodes as they come live. And we appreciate you joining us. Thanks a lot.